You're listening to KXRY Portland, otherwise known as X-Ray FM. Welcome to the Five Quadrants of Portland. I'm your host, Jen Chavez. Today, we'll be looking at issues to be taken up this afternoon and evening in public meetings in Portland. A bit later in the hour, I'm pleased to be joined by Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson from the city's Compliance Officer and Community Liaison, or COCL team, tasked with overseeing Portland's compliance with police reforms mandated by the Department of Justice. The Chicago-based team recently released their first quarterly report on reform progress and will be in Portland for a town hall this evening at Mauna Villa United Methodist Church in Northeast Portland to discuss their report. Stay tuned for that discussion around 12:30. But first, I'm excited to bring Five Quadrants producer Joe Fisher onto the mic. Joe has been instrumental behind the scenes for many of your favorite recent episodes of 5Q, since I know you have favorites. And now he's got a story for us about one of the most passionate debates in recent Portland history, the debate around Portland's drinking water, more specifically around the plan to disconnect the reservoirs at Mount Tabor Park. Joe, welcome. Tell us more.
Thank you for having me on the show. I hope that our listeners aren't thirsty right now, because we're diving deep into some water issues today. When we talk about historical landmarks in Portland, a lot of places come to mind, but if we narrow it down to historic landmarks that have been a vital source to the city, it's hard to argue that some of our reservoirs, specifically Mount Tabor, are a local favorite, an architectural marvel, and a staple to the communities for over 100 years now. Although Mount Tabor and Washington Park reservoirs were both put on the National Register of Historic Places in 2004, it wasn't enough to save them from a 2006 Environmental Protection Agency federal ruling that required all open-air reservoirs to be covered or treated. 10 years later, we have empty reservoirs at Washington Park, and Mount Tabor's future is being fought for, leading up to today's land use appeal hearing over disconnecting the reservoirs. The city council has received much criticism over disconnecting the reservoirs, with citizens and advocates feeling that they haven't tried hard enough to preserve these locations or the landmarks. And to say that the advocates are upset would be somewhat of an understatement. Within the month of May, protesters have successfully shut down two city council meetings concerning the reservoirs, which has led the city to restrict the number of people in attendance for today's hearing. These meetings have been met with fiery advocates, yelling and screaming, and grievances from both parties alike. But the city says the yelling and screaming matches that have been taking place aren't acceptable. And Dana Haynes, Mayor Charlie Hill's spokesman, has gone on to say the lack of decorum will not be accepted in these meetings, and that the protesters are using bully tactics to get what they want. Which has now led us to today. At 2 p.m., the city council will have a land use appeal hearing of a recent plan by the Historic Landmark Commission to disconnect the Mount Tabor reservoirs. And while the council is hoping to control the mood and the rhetoric of the meeting, there is still expected to be some voiced opinions, and some might be louder than others. Today in our studio, we have Oregonian City Hall reporter Andrew Thien, who has reported on the Mount Tabor reservoir issues for quite some time now, and he has seen and heard the arguments of both sides of this contentious topic, and we've brought him in today to share his knowledge with us and our loyal listeners. Andrew, thanks for joining the show today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So today we're talking about some historical landmarks, so let's just start there. What's the history of Mount Tabor reservoirs and the park's use for the drinking water? It's dated, but what can you tell us about it?
Sure. You kind of set a good groundwork dating back more than a century. In the late 1890s, when Portland was still, kind of a frontier town that was growing, that was when the first reservoirs were built at Mount Tabor, 1895. And water in Portland has always been a really beloved topic, and you know, Bull Run Watershed, which is east of town, about 40 minutes, sits in the Mount Hood National Forest. It's really a miracle of gravity that there are the reservoirs there, and there's pipes that just bring the water from the reservoirs out at Bull Run into town at Mount Tabor, and it's worked well for a century, and that's kind of some of the bones of the system, but Mount Tabor has always been a very beloved place.
Gotcha. And can you talk about the EPA's LT2, their water surface treatment regulation, how it means and kind of how it introduced and set this debate in motion?
Sure. You mentioned that it was 2006 that it was adopted, but years before, really, is when this whole issue came to the fore. 1993 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, several hundred people died from a cryptosporidium, which is a bacteria parasite, a waterborne parasite in water. They died, and hundreds of thousands were sickened. It was kind of a combination of a water issue and a sewage issue, but dating back in 1993, the Fed said, okay, look, we need to do something about this. That's when it still started to get the ball rolling a little bit in terms of open air reservoirs and securing the water supplies of major cities. The 9/11 terrorist attacks also had an effect. Just saying, look, this isn't secure. This could be a target for terrorists. And so this kind of slow boil sped up until the EPA had this federal rule, which Portland has agreed to follow.
So the city council, yeah, and the Water Bureau say they're just following the federal ruling, but
right.
Protesters and advocates feel like they just haven't tried hard enough and to fight the federal and to preserve the reservoirs. Why the distrust? Do the advocates feel like there are ulterior motives? How easy would it be to fight this regulation?
There's some good questions there. I mean, it depends on who you ask. The city city commissioners, Water Bureau Administrator David Schaff, who is retiring later this summer, will say, look, we have fought this tooth and nail. We along with New York City teamed up and filed an injunction to try to stop this years ago. We were turned away. Commissioner Novick briefly had the Water Bureau in 2013. He asked the Oregon Health Authority, which is kind of in charge of this stuff here locally, what can we do to get a variance? And the feds and the state regulatory commission that's in charge of water has said, you can't have a variance out of the cover or treat aspect of it. Portland is the only city in the country that doesn't have to treat its water at its source. They have a variance that David Schaff is very proud of, and it just means they have this, they have to test a lot for cryptosporidium. And so they test at the source. They don't have to build a $200 million plant. And the city says, look, we're gonna follow what the EPA said, and that's removing these five reservoirs from service.
So, yeah, and I was going to touch on that, how, they've filed a waiver, they've asked for a variance. It seems like they have tried, and the EPA
right.
just really hasn't budged on it. So do the protests have an intention of, trying to even go and put pressure on EPA, or do they just see them as, too big to go after, and so the city is where they can go for?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the city is... if you talk to Friends of the Reservoirs, who Floyd Jones and people who have been involved with this for a decade plus, they're going to fight every avenue that they have. If the city council approves this land use deal, which would allow construction at Mount Tabor to formally disconnect the reservoirs from the drinking water system, there's still another appeal venue with the State Land Use Board of Appeals. Beyond that, I don't really know what recourse folks have. There's been this discussion for years now that the EPA is going to have a revised LT2 regulations that will come out sometime soon in the next year or so. So that's kind of been something that the opponents have looked to as hope.
Mm, yeah, just some sort of sign of
exactly.
Something might change. Yeah. So, and the reservoirs are still in working condition, so
right.
They can still be used, but it's just because of all the, what's happened over the last 10, 20 years, basically, that has changed all of that.
Right. And dating back to, I believe it was 2012, that's when the city formally adopted this plan of how they're going to respond to the EPA rule. And that's, you know, building a new tank at Powell Butte, a 50 million gallon reservoir, and replacing a tank at Kelly Butte with a larger 25 million gallon underground tank. And again, the city says it's not just the feds, it's not just the cryptosporidium thing. It's a seismic issue as well. Underground, these are going to be a lot safer in the event that we do have the big one here in Portland,
right,
which everyone
right.
is always worried about. I mean, these are historic structures, the reservoirs dating back, you know, to the late 1890s in some case, like we said. So, again, very contentious issue.
Yeah. So you talked about Powell Butte and Kelly Butte. Mm-hmm. They're now up and running, and the
right.
openings, they were delayed. Powell Butte even failed some leaking tests in its early development stages. Have the feelings like changed towards those new reservoirs now that they're up and going, or kind of what's the feelings towards them?
Well, I guess you'd have to probably ask the activists about that. But like you mentioned, when they first came online, the city said, we self-reported to the State Department of Environmental Quality that there was leakage from these reservoirs that were not properly, you know, it was leaking chlorinated water into Johnson Creek, and it was a $40,000 fine. And they said, look, we've self-reported that. We've addressed that. There haven't been any, you know, formal reports of leaks since then. But the weird thing about water is, like, you just turn on the faucet and you expect it to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Powell Butte has been in the system since 1981, the first reservoir. So, you know, that's been working fine as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
So with the second tank and the Kelly Butte tank online, again, you turn on those faucets, you get in the shower, you do the dishwasher, you don't think about it generally.
Exactly. Right. So if the reservoirs are closed and they want to empty them for, you know, whatever reason, where is this water going to go? Do they just dump it? Is it going to be used for anything? They have the 60 days of the year where they can leave it empty, but
right.
you know, where's the water going to go? Basically?
Talking about Mount Tabor.
Yeah, Mount Tabor. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Mount Tabor, the proposal that the city council is considering, it would physically disconnect. This is the federal requirements. You have to disconnect, so there's no way that the water will get into the drinking water system. So there's going to be something like 800 feet of 48-inch pipes installed throughout Mount Tabor Park. That's a little of the background. So in order to, since they're not going to be connected to that system, they need to be connected to another system. That's the stormwater system. So when they flush these reservoirs to clean them, the water will go into the sewage system and then into the Columbia River.
So, and with that kind of happening, and especially with drought concerns, not only locally but nationally, that I don't know if that would. I mean, that seems somewhat of a waste in a way.
Sure, that's a good point. You know, I've talked to not recently, but in the past 6 months, talked to the to David Schaff, the water administrator, and when I was on a tour of the Bull Run watershed, and I said, you know, what do we have enough water? In the context of this was the infamous urination incident and flushing, and David Schaff said, look. We're not in trouble here in Oregon. We have billions of gallons of water. It rains, and it can fill up a Bull Run watershed pretty quickly. So it will be interesting to see going forward conservation efforts when we are flushing a system repeatedly. Just, you know, there will be some policy decisions perhaps. You know, Portland has a lot of water.
Yeah. And if you are just joining us on the Five Quadrants of Portland, I'm speaking with City Hall reporter for the Oregonian, Andrew Thien. And the situation in Washington Park is similar, but has some differences.
Mm-hmm.
The proposed plans show a complete renovation of the park where the reservoir lies, creating a large reflecting pool, many other changes to the landscape. Some activists have argued that Washington Park has received more attention and support from the city than Mount Tabor. Do you think that's a valid argument?
Yeah, I think that the argument that you're citing is that maybe there was better attention and more thought put into the application to disconnect or take those reservoirs out of commission, and that's one of the arguments that the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association is making in their appeal of this the Mount Tabor land use application. That's a lot of jargon, but basically they're saying, look, we want to make sure that at Tabor you're taking care of this place and making it look nice and making it a historic site going forward. And I didn't hear a lot of opposition from neighborhood groups on the west side in terms of the Washington Park reservoir. Some of the formal complaints were more of, you know, this is construction in our park, this is going to take a while. Because it is. It's going to take several years to finish that project. But really, Mount Tabor is being at the center of the city geographically and being more visible to average Portlanders, one could argue. The reservoirs are really connected with that park. It's been a hotter issue in my mind.
Yeah, and basically it leads me to how it's gotten to this point. You know, mm-hmm. Understandably, you've hit it on the nose. It's a really important topic to many of the Portlanders. But why is it ramped up with such like vitriol and passion, and people getting, you know, so crazy about it, basically, you know?
It's a good question, because there's a lot of people who have been very invested and involved in protecting what they see as a neighborhood jewel, mm-hmm. and that's the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, largely, who say, okay, this is going to happen, they're going to be disconnected, we get it, but please make sure that you keep water in them. Please make sure that you actually take care of these structures that are, you know, deteriorating. You can go out there and see it. You know, if you see there are chain link fences, that's not a historic resource. There are light fixtures that are, you know, the neighborhood group says those belong in a strip mall, essentially. So they're saying you need to take care of it. So that's one group. Then there's the group that is just does not believe that the city has done any effort or gone far enough to fight the feds, and they will not accept it. And then there's another group that kind of emerged in December that I've never seen before, that you mentioned vitriol. They are really taking it to the next level. These are folks who shut down the city council meeting a couple weeks ago.
Right, and yeah, on one of your articles in the Oregonian there, or on Oregon Live, there was a video from the Washington Park reservoir hearing on May 13th, and you can see and hear the protesters raising their voices, yelling. Based on the video, the city council members can't seem to get a word in. While some protesters stand behind those tactics, mm-hmm. other protesters and groups have expressed to you that they feel it's counterproductive and taken away from the arguments like the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association or Friends of the Reservoir. Can you tell more about the debate around kind of the tactics for that?
Well, I haven't gotten into that too much lately in terms of talking to folks about how they feel about that that situation that you kind of outlined. But back in December, when this kind of very loud, for lack of a better word, rude, I don't know, group came out, you know, talking to Mount Tabor neighborhood groups. They had never seen these people before, and they'd been involved in advocating for the reservoirs for a decade, and they'd never seen these people. So, and, you know, I've been, right before I came in here, I was on Twitter, and people were tweeting, why is the balcony going to be closed for the meeting today? And it's really a direct result of how Commissioner Fish and Fritz felt they were treated, I guess, in this December meeting, and then the meeting from a couple weeks ago on the Washington Park reservoirs, that again was shut down from folks literally screaming. kind of counterproductive.
Right, right. And so, yeah, today's the, like you said, they shut down the balcony for today's land use appeal hearing. And so it's limiting the number of people that are going to be able to be there.
Right.
But council members, they're still expecting some outbursts to carry over and have even said that if anybody in attendance shows, like, disruptive behavior, they can be kicked out and face future exclusions.
Right.
And I believe they're going to have, like, the live television feed over at the Portland building. And activists, they've cried foul, calling the city's decision kind of a suppression of their First Amendment rights. How would you characterize the response to this decision?
Well, it's interesting. I've never seen this. Granted, I've only been covering City Hall since 2013. But, you know, talking to my colleague Brad Schmidt, he can't recall a meeting where they shut the balcony. Pretty much any contentious meeting, which inevitably in city politics, there are many. Here in Portland, there are often some heated issues that are controversial, like the Right to Dream 2 move or Uber vote. And that balcony is always open. And then typically there's an overflow room inside City Hall. The mayor's office says, look, we're giving them a bigger room in the Portland building. So we're not limiting attendance. Still, you're a building away, and you have to walk over if you're signed up to testify. So, it's an interesting dynamic. There's just been a lot of rising tension lately. Just yesterday, there was a gentleman who brought out a bullhorn and just started yelling through the bullhorn at city council. So people are upset. You know, yeah. I mean, and that could be a direct result of city council action. That could be what's going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. Who knows? So it'll be an interesting meeting tonight, and it definitely won't solve the issue. Mm-hmm. I don't expect the council to vote tonight.
Right. And some final question. What do you think the mood will be like today at the meeting? It's going to be different than the last couple ones, but how do you think it's going to kind of happen today?
Yeah, no, I think these meetings, typically there's, well, this is an unusual meeting for several reasons. There are two groups appealing the land use decision. The city is appealing the decision, saying, look, we can't be expected to keep water in there all but 60 days a year. That's not feasible. And then the Mount Tabor neighborhood group, and we already talked about their grievances. But I expect that, you know, sitting there and listening to these presentations for an hour, people are going to get a little heated before they get a chance to speak. That's only, I think, natural when you have to sit and listen to other people talk for a long time. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting meeting, given that there could very well be dozens of people in a separate building. I don't know. I'm kind of interested in seeing how it plays out.
And people from the Portland building, they can come through and testify, like, once the council member is wrapped up, they can walk over. Is that
right? You know? The process that I've been told, there's a sign-up sheet ahead of the meeting. Everyone can sign up. And for all meetings, the council clerk will read out the next three are so-and-so and so-and-so, and the three after are so-and-so and so-and-so. So if you hear your name in the Portland building, then I guess you book it on over, because you have 2 minutes to testify. So it could be a little bit of a logistical thing tonight. Should be interesting.
Yeah, it should be very interesting. So that's happening at 2 p.m. today. And Andrew, I got to thank you for coming on the show and just spreading the knowledge about what's going on. You definitely helped out, and the listeners,
hey,
appreciate it very much.
Thanks for inviting me. Appreciate it.
All right. Coming up on Five Quadrants of Portland, Jen Chavez speaks with Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson with the city's team tasked with overseeing federally mandated police reforms. Coming up on Five Quadrants of Portland.
Support for X-Ray FM comes from BTU Brasserie, a craft brewery serving Chinese food and craft brewed lagers and ales, located at 5846 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Now open for happy hour 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. Tuesday through Friday. Vegetarian and gluten-free options available. More information can be found at btupdx.com.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the Five Quadrants of Portland. I'm Jan Chavez. Longtime listeners of the Five Quadrants of Portland and many consumers of local media in general may know about the City of Portland's settlement agreement with the Department of Justice. The federal agency's Civil Rights Division found in 2012 that the Portland Police Bureau engaged in a pattern or practice of excessive force against people with actual or perceived mental illness. Fast forward 2.5-ish years to today, the lawsuit was settled in a comprehensive settlement agreement that mandated sweeping police reforms in many categories of enforcement. Some of the mechanisms in the settlement agreement have already been put in place, but many will tell you that there's a long way to go yet. And overseeing the progress is the city-appointed COCL team. That's short for Compliance Officer Community Liaison. The Chicago-based Rosenbaum and Watson LLC make up this team, and they'll be releasing quarterly reports assessing compliance by the city on a broad range of reforms. Well, this month they released their very first quarterly report, and it's a fascinating read. It's also a report that comes in the wake of the recent withdrawal of former Oregon Chief Justice Paul DeMunez from the team as its locally based member. I'm joined now by two members of the COCL team, Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson, for more details on their fresh report. Dennis, Amy, thank you so very much for joining me, and welcome to the Five Quadrants of Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, certainly. So just to start, your team was selected for this position last fall. What background did you and your team bring to the table during your application process? What work have you previously done elsewhere in the country that you saw as applicable during that process?
Well, we've been involved in a number of projects. Myself, I've been the executive director of the National Police Research Platform, and so we have been studying police organizations in 100 American cities for the last 6 years. So we have a lot of understanding of how police organizations, what is organizational excellence and what is good policing. And of course, we've also, in about half of those cities, measured the quality of treatment that occurs between the police and the community. So we've been thinking a lot about what is fair and respectful and non-aggressive interaction. And Dr. Watson maybe wants to comment on her background too.
Oh yeah, please.
Yeah, I've been doing work for the past 10-15 years looking at police response to mental illness. So I've done some studies actually looking at the perspective of people with mental illness on police interactions, but then also I've been working with Chicago Police Department, and I've done some work with other cities as well around improving their response. So my particular expertise relevant to this project is really around looking at their response to mental health crisis.
Got it. And that is certainly a central issue of the settlement agreement and the reforms ahead. Now, you've produced your very first quarterly report, released this month, a comprehensive 95-pager. Now, one of your main roles is to monitor compliance, but in this report you say you're reserving using the label of compliance at this time. To what degree have you been capable of assessing things at this stage? What did you seek to establish with this first report?
Well, the main objective here was to lay out the terrain of the settlement so that the public in Portland and the members of the community could see the various demands that would be made on the Portland Police Bureau. It's a very extensive settlement, so it has dozens and dozens of conditions that have to be met over a number of years. And we wanted to lay that out and also tell the community how we were going to go about evaluating whether the City of Portland and the Portland Police Bureau are in compliance with that settlement agreement. And we also do make some initial impressions that we have of these various areas covered by the settlement in terms of policies and training and data systems and that sort of thing. And so That's basically what we were trying to do.
Got it. And
yeah,
go on, Amy.
Okay, yeah, we weren't really able to have a lot in terms of conclusions on compliance at this point because we're kind of looking at what the police bureau is doing, what data systems are in place or that might need to be enhanced so that we can actually start doing some work to look at how the changes they have made are impacting kind of what's happening on the ground level. So we're just sort of preparing to really be able to pull together all the information we would need to determine compliance, and then we'll want to watch that over time to make sure any changes that are made that are positive are being sustained.
Got it. A large part of each subcategory in your report was dedicated to talking about how you were going to be monitoring this thing. And I found it interesting that you repeatedly said that your role goes beyond just checking the box, and you're going to be looking at these things much more comprehensively. So let's dive right in, shall we? The settlement agreement has seven main components, if I'm not mistaken. Plus, you've added policy development, which is related to all of it, really. But let's look back at the major finding of the Department of Justice, a pattern or practice of excessive use of force. And so matters around use of force serve as really the baseline for this report. You haven't commented on individual cases of use of force in this report, but you have taken issue with the data keeping around use of force incidences and the transparency issues caused and how that relates to your ability to even monitor how these things are going. What are your initial concerns about the way the Bureau has been keeping track of uses of force?
Well, the Portland Police Bureau has a number of data systems, as do any large police department, and some of them are new or some are old, but they serve a purpose of looking at individual cases, but it's hard as they're currently constructed to analyze the data in different ways and look for patterns and what we call a relational database. It doesn't have the qualities of that, but that's not uncommon in police organizations, but it's essential here to be able to see the bigger picture and see the forest for the trees, so to speak. And whether we can help them think through a kind of way to construct the current systems that are functional to get out all the data that's needed, or whether we have to recommend an entirely new system for Portland, we haven't decided that yet. So we need to look at that a little more carefully. But the idea here for the public listening is that police departments that are doing a good job of monitoring their employees have systems in place so that they can keep track of every use of force incident, other kinds of behaviors that put officers at risk, put the public at risk, and to be able to monitor those things, track them over time, look at individual officers, look at groups of officers, look at the way different groups of people are being treated. There's a lot of aggregation of data that has to go on, as well as just individual cases. I think historically, police are inclined to look case by case at individual incidents and individual suspects and individual victims and that sort of thing.
I see. So
there's
like
a new way of looking at that.
Yeah, there's an effort to look, like you said, relationally at past data. Great. So you move on in your report to police training. And now this is interesting because the city auditor in March put out a fairly critical report on police training, of which you seem somewhat skeptical. You quote, recommend caution when drawing conclusions. Why did you react in that way? How do your impressions differ, do you feel, from the impressions of the city auditor?
I think one thing for the training report, as researchers, we have a different approach to kind of looking at, what the patterns might be, what the outcomes from the different types of training and the quality of training. So I think some of our caution is really looking at, can you make really strong conclusions based on the data that was examined? Is it more anecdotal? Is it more of a pattern? So our our caution is that it really needs to be looked at much more deeply before we can make any conclusions about the adequacy of the training and if officers really, you know, are getting what they need so that their behavior is what we want it to be out on the street.
Yeah, let me add to that. I think, first of all, training is just critically important to this whole reform effort. And we think that the auditor did a good job of writing a thorough report. One of our other concerns that Dr. Watson did not mention is that that report is based on data that's about a year old now. And the Portland Police Bureau has done a lot since then to implement new policies and new training initiatives. However, having said that, I want to be absolutely clear that at this point in time, we are not saying those training programs are adequate. We're going to take a very careful and critical look at those programs to see if they are both responsive to the settlement terms and are implemented in a way that has a high probability of being effective at changing attitudes and behaviors on the street, and in fact would like to document the impact of these training programs. So there's a lot of, and are the programs being carried out in a way there's high fidelity and integrity to the implementation of these programs? So training is really critical, and historically training in policing has been kind of a talking heads PowerPoint kind of thing, and it's really critical that they get beyond that to do real live role playing and scenarios that interact with individuals in potentially mental health crisis situations, other individuals that are upset, angry, intoxicated, etc., and how they handle those situations.
Got it. And you do mention in your initial impressions at this stage that one thing that you would like to see more training focus on is procedural justice. Could you talk more about what that is and how you've seen it as a deficiency in current PPB training?
Well, we haven't looked thoroughly at everything they're offering, so it's possible they have something there that meets that standard. But our first glance at it suggests that there's more to work to be done there. And procedural justice is this idea that the public probably understands this at the most basic level. The outcome of an encounter with a police officer is not the only thing that matters. For example, whether you get a ticket or not, it's the process. And that process in particular, there's dozens and dozens of studies now in a half a dozen countries that show that the public cares a great deal about how they're treated. Are they treated respectfully or not? That's one dimension. Are they given a voice or not? Is the officer listening to them and hearing what they have to say and not just talking to them or telling them what to do? Is the officer being fair and objective and neutral and not making decisions based on the color of a person's skin or their gender or sexual orientation? That's a critical dimension as well, fairness. And then another dimension that's been shown to be important is genuine concern and compassion and empathy for people's situations, so showing concern for their welfare. In my own research, I find that in various cities, the police score the lowest on that dimension. But again, when these behaviors are exhibited by police officers, what happens is that the individual citizens are more satisfied with the encounter. They're less likely to resist efforts by the police to get them to cooperate with certain behaviors, to comply with certain commands. They even are more likely to obey the law. It's pretty incredible. And they believe more in the legitimacy of the police, that the police are acting reasonably and fairly, and therefore I will give them due respect. And Dr. Watson has also found this work to be similar in mental health situations, right, in some of your work.
Yeah, we've looked at procedural justice specifically in encounters with police and people with mental illness, and you know it holds true is that people pay a lot of attention to how they're treated, and if they're treated respectfully and with concern, they're much more satisfied. They're also much more likely to cooperate, which provides the opportunity for something to be de-escalated and have a useful solution to whatever the situation is. So it really does make a big difference.
And I'm glad you brought up mental health, because of course that's a central element of the settlement agreement. The Portland police and the city are playing a stronger role, in crisis intervention techniques or responding to community members in mental health crisis. You say the city has made big steps in this area with the creation of mental health crisis response units. Something called the Memphis model is repeatedly emphasized for Portland, a model you say the Bureau deviated from when it provided 40 hours of crisis intervention for all officers. What is the Memphis model, and why would you argue that this deviation is potentially damaging?
The Memphis model has a number of components. One is the 40 hours of specialized training for officers to recognize signs and symptoms of mental illness. They practice de-escalation skills. They also have a lot of contact with the service providers, with family members, and with people with mental illnesses as part of the training. And that's just one piece of it. The other elements of the model include that officers that become CIT certified are officers that volunteer for that role. So they may already be the officers that are better at responding to mental health calls. They're interested in responding to these calls. And then you give them some extra skills and identify them as the officers that should be sent. Also, a big piece is that collaboration piece with providers and other agencies in the community. And when you have this subgroup of specialists that sort of self-select into that role, then they're responsible also for making sure those collaborations stay in place and, you know, reporting back to a CIT coordinator if there's issues so that problems can be resolved on an ongoing basis. And since they're the specialists handling the mental health calls, they become familiar with what service options are available in the community. They may be familiar with specific individuals or their families, and they develop those relationships too that can come in really handy in a crisis situation to really kind of bring it down when that trust may already be there. So I think that's a really important piece. So training everybody in CIT, I agree all officers need a basic competency in recognizing that they're dealing with someone that may be experiencing symptoms and recognizing that there may be a different approach that they need to take. But to sort of make everybody CIT and have no specialists, you lose some of the other pieces of the model. It's also hard to provide the true model of CIT training on a large scale because of the need for the involvement of community members, consumers, and family members. And, you know, I know that, you know, there's different ways of doing it, but it's just a little bit harder to then provide the same quality on a larger scale.
Got it. So folks, if you're just tuning into the Five Quadrants of Portland, I'm speaking with Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson of the city's COCL team tasked with overseeing Portland's compliance with federally mandated police reforms. I'd like to ask now about the community's role in reforms and what your thoughts are on community involvement to this point. For one, you point out that several key areas of the reform process have lacked substantial community input or outside input. But on the other hand, the Community Oversight Advisory Board you chair, your report was somewhat critical of their progress, and you say, quote, that there's been considerable pressure on COAB members from outside groups to pursue an activist approach to police reform versus a collaborative partnership model. So I'm wondering what your take is on how effective community involvement has been and how open the reform process has been to community involvement.
Sure, I'd be happy to respond to that. First of all, I think by and large, there may have been a line or two in there that where we were somewhat critical about the process, but generally we're very impressed with the role of the community here in Portland, and it's a unique model. A lot of these settlement agreements in other cities do not have a community role, such as the Community Oversight and Advisory Board, which, for those who are listening, it's a 15 members of the community representing different aspects of Portland, and then five, they're voting members, and then five police officers who are there as non-voting members, 20 people total. And they have done actually an amazing amount since they were started in January in terms of getting organized and setting up an executive committee and three subcommittees. And there's been some challenges along the way. We had Chief Justice Paul DeMunis was overseeing this work for a while, but he stepped down for personal reasons, and we now are ready to appoint a new person. And but I wanted to say, in terms of different approaches, there are Portland, as you know, is a diverse community with lots of different perspectives, and there is a strong activist component in Portland, and I totally understand it and respect it, because there has been a lot of issues over the last many decades, and Portland's not unique in that. Our whole country is going through a bit of a crisis right now, post Ferguson and other places. But we're trying to get a lot done in a very constrained environment, where we're under pressure, both as the COCAL and they are as the COAB, which we work together jointly, to study the compliance and of the Portland Police Bureau on so many dimensions, that we do need a mutually respectful, cooperative partnership, where the city and the police and the DOJ and us and the COAB all work together to keep our separate and independent and very important independence roles, but yet be mutually respectful and move ahead with trusting each other to get things done. And so I think we're there now. We're beginning to get to that point. And so, in fact, we have a big meeting tonight. And I think, but to put it in a larger context, as you know, the whole country is going through a period where there's an enormous amount of anger toward law enforcement and policing after these use of force and excessive deadly force incidents against mostly against persons of color, but also in a number of cases of mental health. And the police are, as someone who studies the police as well, I like to acknowledge that they are feeling an enormous sense of pressure on them and feeling villainized as a group, even though it's a small percentage of officers who have made these mistakes. And so we're at a critical time in this country where it's important. Otherwise, what I worry about is that the police are going to back away from doing the job that they need to do. And yet, in Portland, the community is going to hold them accountable. And I think that the police, need to be very community-oriented. They need to be very transparent and open with their operations. They need to let the community in. They need to pursue community policing approaches that seek to engage the community in a whole variety of ways. And I think that's going to happen. It's just going to be a long road, and people are rightfully standing up and being critical, and that's what they need to do. And that's what makes Portland unique. It's a unique model of engaging the community, letting them have a role in this oversight process, and they have a real role, and they're going to speak up, and we look forward to getting their comments tonight on our draft report.
Excellent. We just have a little bit of time left, but I do have a couple more questions, one of which you mentioned that you have recommended better community policing, community outreach, procedural justice, as we were talking about earlier. I was particularly interested in your recommendation for a truth and reconciliation process with marginalized communities, such as those with lived experience with mental illness or minority communities of other kinds. What do you envision that looking like, and how do you envision that repairing a clear lack of trust between the police and the community?
Well, we're going to leave that up to the community and the COAB and the leaders of Portland community to decide exactly how that should play out. I mean, we can just help connect them to resources. There are some people around the country, some folks out of the Office of Justice Programs who are helping to facilitate some of these matters. But the basic idea for those who are listening is really that there's been harm that's been done in the past. And when we don't acknowledge that and we don't recognize that, especially today, we live in such a litigious society that police and others are not willing to say there was any wrongdoing. And I think that yet there's been harm. I mean, the police are much more professional today than they were in the past, but for a couple hundred years they were basically on the wrong side of history. And even through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and on to today, there's still examples of this, as we know, in the media and on YouTube, of mistakes that are harmful, that the community has been hurt and traumatized by some of these incidents. And the point is that people need to feel that there's an acknowledgement up front that harm's been done, that there's some sort of public kind of an effort to apologize. We borrow these concepts, of course, from South Africa and other places where there's been enormous problems over the years, but they seem to apply to problems in America as well. And I think that there has to be a healing process, in other words, that you have to heal, and people have to acknowledge problems, apologize, and make a commitment to work together. And that's why we're pushing collaboration. But we think that Portland will come up with its own version of this through its community leaders and through the COAB, and we don't want to be the ones dictating what they should do.
Excellent. Well, in the last 2 minutes of the show, I just wanted to ask about, you mentioned it a little bit before, the resignation of Paul de Munoz. I'm wondering what void that's left in your team and what you've looked for in seeking his local replacement.
Well, what we were looking for is someone with also with substantial status and respect in Portland and throughout the state of Oregon, someone who understands various marginalized groups throughout the city, from the mental health community, from people of color to the people who are houseless in Portland, and others with various disabilities and challenges. And we have come up with a person, and her name is Kathleen Sadat, and we are excited to have her on our team. She's worked for the state, she's worked for the county, she's worked for the city, she's been a community activist as well for all communities, so we're excited to have her, and she will be showing up tonight at the COAB meeting.
Oh, terrific. Out of curiosity, does she have experience working with mental health issues, for example, like you, Amy?
I don't believe that she has direct experience working with mental health issues, but she's done quite a bit of community work and with different groups. So if you look at the rate of mental illness in the general population and the broader experience of different communities, I think she's got the skill set to really pull that together and help people work respectfully together.
Got it. Well, thank you guys very much for speaking with me. And I've been speaking with Dennis Rosenbaum and Amy Watson of the Compliance Officer Community Liaison Team.